I sent out a letter this week with a video, Turn, Turn, Turn. It was written in 1959 by Peter Seeger, and it was sung by the Byrds. And I'm dating a lot of you, aren't I? His publisher was sick and tired of Seeger's protest songs. He wanted him to break from being that musical prophet and appeal to a broader audience. He wanted Seeger to do another Goodnight Irene, a song that Seeger had stole from somebody else and then popularized. Seeger told him to find another songwriter, and he hung up. And then he proceeded to pull out of his pocket his notebook with all these scattered notes, and on those scattered notes he had pieces of Ecclesiastes 3 written down, and he took those passages almost verbatim for the song, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, and a time to uproot. Now many here know the biblical text, not because you were holy and you were memorizing it, but because you first sang that song in a 60s VW yellow and gold bus with flower power on the side. Seeger sent the song to his publisher, and Seeger was so pleased that his publisher didn't get it. He didn't understand it. One writer said that Seeger added the turn, 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 kind of build this chorus, and then tack on his own hopeful concluding line for a Cold War audience. A time of peace, I swear it's not too late. He had sung a time for war and a time for peace earlier in the song, but at the end he concluded, a time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time for love, a time for hate, a time for peace, I swear it's not too late. That's the way the song ends. That's the prophet. Well, time brings all those Ecclesiastes 3 experiences, and sometimes just moments apart. Just moments apart. A person's in my study and they're sobbing over life's unfairness, and they leave wiping away the tears, hoping nobody sees them. And as they walk out, someone's sitting there waiting, and that person comes right in because they've just had the most hilarious thing happen and they had to tell somebody. And I get to be that person. A time to weep, a time to laugh hysterically. But Ecclesiastes goes on in verse 9. We know the burden of work, the stress that cut hay on the ground with little sun and cool temperatures and much rain last night. And I know the farmers in here are saying, tell me about it. But remember, God has made everything beautiful in its time, and he's also set eternity in our hearts. That's what it says. And yet we can't fathom what God has done from the beginning to the end. We have this sense of duration of time. That's what it's talking about in our hearts, eternity. But we can never stand back far enough to get that big God picture. We're always lacking that ability. We worry about the future. We grieve about the past. We, image of God bearers, are just different from all the other animals, right? Poem lines like Wendell Berry's that I've quoted before, just the one line, it pulls at our hearts. And I want to say this morning, it's pulling at our hearts from another world. I come into the peace of wild things who do not tax their lives with forethought of grief. They don't tax their lives with the forethought of grief. That's a haunting line. Why? Because the beasts don't have that eternity in their hearts. And it is Augustine penned, you stir us so that praising you may bring us joy, because you have made us and drawn us to yourself, and our heart is unquiet until it rests in you. Your heart, not your head, your heart. There's always longing, unrest, and disquiet in the human heart. Even when we sense this peace, it's just peace that it's good, but we know that it's not complete. There's always unrest. Ooh. We can't satisfy the longing. Oh, we try, right? There's this universal human nature reality. We are always the longing heart people. We always long with our hearts. We want more. We want better. Even when we experience the best, there's still more. I mean, Lewis talked about this, of course, in Mere Christianity. I mean, he just said creatures aren't born with desires unless there's satisfaction for those desires. So a baby's born with hunger and there's food, and a duck's born, it wants to swim, well, there's water, and men and women are born and they have these sexual desires, and well, there's sex. But if we find in ourselves a desire, he writes, which no experience in this world can satisfy, the probable explanations, we're made for another world. There's another world pulling at us. Pulling at us. NASA sent Voyager 1 and 2 out of the solar system with a recording of the sounds of the Earth. The sounds of Earth. And they were hoping some extraterrestrial would enjoy it. I want you to know I love that. I really do love that. Why are we so arrogant that we think that God used up all of his creativity on us in this vast universe? Well, on the sounds of the Earth was Beethoven's Opus 130. Opus 130, Beethoven. Because music's one of these ways God really gets at us. And Beethoven had written in the margins of that original masterpiece on the manuscript as he was working, Sehnsucht. It's a German word. Sehnsucht. The mysterious desire. Sehnsucht, it's this yearning. Sehnsucht, as one author said, when we experience Sehnsucht rather than just thinking about it, it is obsessive and imperious. In fact, even more imperious than erotic desires at its height. Sehnsucht. That's why two philosophers came together and they wrote this pretty thick book on arguments for the existence of God. And they had 20, and they give an argument, and then they go off on pages defending and talking about the argument. Well, their 17th argument was what they called the aesthetic experience, the experience of the heart, beauty. And this was their argument. There is the music of Johann Sebastian Bach. Therefore, there must be a God. There is the music of Bach. There must be a God. And then here is their explanation after that. You either see this one or you don't. It's brilliant. I want to ask, do you ever feel that our world is haunted? I could use the word enchanted. I could use Rudolf Adels in his classic book on religious experience. He calls it the numinous. Do you ever have this sense that our world is inhabited and penetrated and haunted and enchanted by an unseen presence that can fill your very being with fear and awe? You can't predict the experience. You can't control or duplicate it. It explodes definability. You can't define it. There's no taming the numinous. Or as Tom Howard, Protestant turned Catholic guy, wrote, he just said, he's Christ the tiger. Christ is a tiger. You don't tame the tiger. It seems to come from another dimension, another kind of reality than the world it invades. God places eternity in our hearts, and out of that, he is invading and pointing and pressing in on us. I read this passage up to this point. This past week, I read it up to my good friend Grant. Grant called me. Grant is a naturalist, and he is a really, really good friend. He called having had this, what I would call an atheist, transcendent, non-transcendent moment. He was disturbed. And I placed our conversation in the context of a movie. The movie's called Jeff Who Lives at Home. Connor, have you ever seen it? Okay, you can borrow it, but yeah, I got to get it back. Jeff is a 30-something man living in his mom's basement. Okay? He doesn't work. And he has a brother, Pat, that's married, but that relationship is unraveling throughout the movie. And the movie starts with Jeff getting a phone call in his mom's basement. The phone rings. He picks it up. Hello, is Kevin there? Well, Jeff says, nah, there's no Kevin here. Don't mess with me, man. Get Kevin on the phone. This is Jeff. There's no Kevin that lives here, and there is no Kevin that is here. Don't give me that blankety blank 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 and put Kevin on the phone right now. And he says, there is no Kevin here. And the guy on the other end just hangs up. He says, that's weird. So Jeff leaves the house, and the first thing he sees in the neighborhood is this truck, Kevin's Candy. So he runs, and he jumps on the back of it, and so he can go where this is going because there must be a sign. It's odd. And he gets off, and the truck goes parks, and as he's standing there, he notices that this guy is crossing the street, and he's wearing this really cool basketball jersey. And as he walks across the street, on the back of his jersey, it says, Kevin. That's even weirder. So he follows him, and next thing you know, they're playing basketball together. Jeff was wondering in all this, who's trying to communicate with me? What's going on here? He feels the haunting, the enchantment, the numinous. So he stalks Kevin and he starts playing basketball with Kevin and his friends, and then Kevin invites him to go smoke some weed. So they go smoke some weed, and while they're smoking the weed, Kevin and his friends rob Jeff and beat him and leave him. Kevin. It's a great movie. And then there's this relationship between Jeff and his brother. And Pat's this realist, and he's going through the motions of life under the sun because there is no life above the sun that's invading the earth. There's no transcendence. No God is ever mentioned. God is never mentioned in the movie. Nothing's penetrating the world, invading the world, haunting the world. And he thinks his brother Jeff, Pat thinks his brother Jeff, he's not the sharpest knife in the drawer. Pat just can't come to see the world like Jeff. So while they're spying out Pat's wife because they think she's sleeping around, they end up at a cemetery because their dad had died recently and was buried. So they decided to go visit the grave. And like death does, Pat gets vulnerable with his brother, Jeff. And he starts telling him this dream he's been having, where his dad shows up in the dream. And you can see Kevin just kind of smile, and he's getting warm. And as he repeats to Jeff what the dad is saying to him in the dream, Jeff starts saying the same words, and he completes the sentence. And he goes, I've been having that same dream too. I've been having that dream. And they get in a scuffle, and he tries to hug Pat like this is this intimate moment. And Pat pushes him away and says, oh, you are weird. I can't deal with you. Because you see, Pat interprets it all naturally. Dad must have told you and me the story different times, and it's all in our subconscious, and it's just this coincidence. But Jeff sees more. The story goes on. Unmarried loser Jeff counsels married Pat about love and relationships. This is Hollywood, so that can happen and be successful. And Pat realizes he should run after his wife with all the hope of a love that invades from beyond. And so Pat and Jeff, they see his wife, and she gets in her car, and she's driving away, so they grab this cab, and they start following her. And they have the cab. He's trying to catch up with her. And they want to get to her, but all of a sudden, they just come to this standstill of a traffic jam on a bridge. And they don't know what's going on. And so Pat, he jumps out of the car, and he starts running, looking at all the cars that have the same color, and he's thinking, I got to my wife. And then he goes to the next car, and he's out of the cab. And Jeff is sitting in the cab, and he's just looking out, and he looks out over the water, this long bridge. And here comes this helicopter, and it's a rescue helicopter. And he realizes something's going on, and all of a sudden, he just, like, comes alive, and he jumps out of the car, the cab, and he starts running down the bridge, and he comes up to where this huge accident is, and he looks over, and one of the cars had slipped down and had gone into the river. And he looks down, and he looks around, and no one's doing anything, and he gets on the edge, and he jumps in the water, and he dives under, and he goes in, and he pulls out two young elementary kids. And he pulls them over to the somebody in a boat right there that was coming up, and they pull them out. But the girls are yelling, "My dad, our dad, our dad's in there." And he goes back, and he dives down, and he gets the dad loose. And the dad comes up gasping with air, but Jeff has ran out of breath, and he needs to be resuscitated himself. Well, the movie ends with Jeff in his mom's basement again, and he's watching the news the next day. And the girls are talking about how wonderful the man was who saved them and saved their dad. And they were going on and just how scary it was. And the news reporter announces that they'll be right back with the girl's father, Kevin. That's the way the movie ends. Roll it. You know, I go to the Catholic Church to pray because I like the crucifix. And as I was praying there, just this past week, I want you to know, I'm sitting there, and it was quiet. No one was there. The candles were lit, and I was praying, and I was looking up, and the resurrection light of the stained glass was coming through onto the crucifix. And I looked up, and I want you to know, Jesus talked to me from the cross. He talked to me. The lips of the crucifix moved and said, "Mark, build the playground." You know what that means? I do. We've been talking about building the playground out here for the neighborhood for a couple years, and it always gets poo-pooed. He says, "Build the playground." That happened. You don't believe me, do you? I wasn't on drugs. No. Okay, here's what I'm trying to tell you. In that movie, we experience what Charles Taylor calls and described as the imminent frame. This is the where we live. This is where you live and I live. And you can't get out of it because this is our culture. It's the imminent frame. You see, that story I told you about the cross, that was Francis Assisi. "Build my church, Francis." Jesus talked to him from the cross in that little chapel. "Rebuild my church. Rebuild my church." Literally. And he goes and he revolutionizes the church. And people believed him. "But you don't believe me." "Oh, he's not St. Francis. We know that." "Well, of course you know that." But one of the reasons is we live in this imminent frame. It's the other imminent frame of the secular age. Because both Jeff and Pat are in that frame. And Pat thinks all things must be interpreted within that frame. Jeff, though, he's in the imminent frame, but he has more of an open take when things like this happen. Is someone from outside the frame? Is there a crack in the wall of the frame? An opening of the door? A hole where light is coming through, where someone or something is speaking to me and trying to get to me? It's speaking to his heart. Jeff's world is more haunted, invaded, enchanted. Jeff has an open take response. Is something going on here? And I'm being called, I'm being pulled into the mystery of it all. But Pat, he lives what you would call, Charles Taylor calls a cold, closed spin response, closed spin. He just spins it all in the natural frame, the imminent frame. Nothing's going to happen. Everything is a natural explanation. There has to be a natural explanation to this. There's nothing beyond the frame. And we all live in that frame. That's the way it's our natural inclination to go to interpreting everything within that frame. That's the Western culture right now. It's a fascinating book. Well, let's jump to Psalm 19. Psalm 19 is this majestic poem prayer. "The beauty and majesty of creation's heavens declare the glory of God. The skies witness to the artistic work of God's hands. They should give us daily pause." I mean, there's this pouring forth of speech. The grand canvas is a visual Niagara Falls of divine dialect. No one's left out. I mean, I want you to know, there's this phrase. I want you to know a phrase can just haunt you and dance in your mind. I was reading a commentary, and it was just two words. Peter Craig said this. He says it's called an inaudible noise. An inaudible noise. I have heard an inaudible noise sitting at the Rhine in Basel, Switzerland, feeding the pigeons with Annalie and Jesse and Carrie McDonald's French fries. Looking at the Rhine and the beauty, and all of a sudden it's just like this inaudible noise. I've heard the inaudible noise as I stood in the African jungles in stillness. I heard the inaudible noise, and it was deafening, as I stood in silence at the Protestant and the Catholic and the Jewish memorial at Dachau in Germany. It was there. Transforming, pulling. We can pick our place to reside, but the sun will still greet us each morning like clockwork with an inaudible noise. Doesn't matter where you're at. God, the generic word, is used once in the first six verses of Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God is this generic word. And then God has said, and then we get descriptions of God's haunting presence all over the place. But then in the next five verses, we receive in this prayer the covenant name of the Lord, Yahweh. Yahweh, 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 Yahweh. The Lord speaks in words revealed to his people. Now understand, human words are limited. And yet, I'd like to say they're frail linguistic vessels where God impregnates them with his very life by his Spirit. That's what we're told. With the life of the Lord. They are perfect, reviving, sure, wise, simple, right, pure, eye-opening. True, righteous, desirable, sweet. They give warnings. I want you to know I have heard the Lord's voice in Scripture throughout my life. In high school, John the Baptist painted on the walls of my soul, "He must increase, I must decrease." John 3:30. Simple, haunting words. Subconsciously, I want you to know, I really believe this. I have been drawn to the Grunewald crucifixion where these words are inscribed in Latin behind John's pointing finger. Those are the words in Latin as he's pointing at the crucified Christ who's hanging painfully in the painting. I didn't know that was those words were there until way later. And then there is Mark's numinous sentence in Mark chapter 4 that I've never been able to get out of my noggin. Here it is. Leaving the crowd behind, comma. They took Jesus along, comma. Just as he was, comma. In the boat. Leaving the crowd behind, comma. They took Jesus along, comma. Just as he was, comma. In the boat. We leave the crowd to sail through life with Jesus. Think of this. But we take him in our boat as he is and not as we want him to be. It's a sentence that comes into our lives from another world. Do we have this understanding that our world is haunted and enchanted? It was Tolkien who wrote that his stories he had hoped were about desirability. He wanted to create desire and longing. He wanted to heighten that experience. He wanted to satisfy it, he says. He wanted to awaken it and satisfy it. Well, at the same time, he said, whet it unbearably. Or as Gerald Manley Hopkins penned, do we live in the realization that the world is charged with the grandeur of God? It will flame out like shining from shook foil. The world is charged with the grandeur of God. Think of beauty. Beauty is a way God speaks into our lives and pulls at our hearts' desire, giving glimpses of the eternal. It creates longing for this world that this world can't satisfy. We desire this beauty, but guess what? We don't possess the beauty. Beauty is not just in the eyes of the beholder. It's not. Stand at the Grand Canyon, and I dare anyone to say, oh, this is a piece of junk. No, it is objective. It is outside you. It is a beautiful thing in and of itself, not just because you think it is. Beauty thrills us. We enter into beauty. It is objective, and it calls for an arresting of our attention and a slowing down and a taking in. And that thrill can be disproportionate to the beauty that grabs us. I mean, Carrie, one time she stopped at a hay bale, getting out of the car on her way to school to teach out at the Hutterite Colony, because a bald eagle had perched itself there. She talked to it. She took pictures of it. She was pulled in by its beauty. Why does a stinking bird give such joy? It's just a bird. Disproportionate. She wanted to be in its presence. And when we encounter the beautiful, we glance beyond our normal sense of the world. It's a window to what is more. It's that eternity in the heart. It's to God. And then the beautiful vanishes because we can't control it. The eagle flies away, and then Carrie hurries, gets in her car, and she goes off to teach at the school because we can't possess it. God has placed eternity in our hearts, and we get these experiences, subjective experiences of that in our daily lives. Sir John Millais, Everett Millais, painted the picture on the screen. A person wrote, as reflecting on this, they said, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up people to collect wood and don't assign them tasks and work, but rather teach them to long for the endless immensity of the sea. Get them to long for the sea. So in this painting, the boyhood of Raleigh, Sir Walter Raleigh, was an explorer under Queen Elizabeth I. He established some of the first British colonies, now North Carolina, and his heart was adventurous. The immensity of the sea captured his imagination. What captures our imagination? What's God using to pull us to the immensity of his being that we can't even describe? Our words fail us. They're these frail vessels that we try to describe who God is, but it's like, just shut up and be in his presence. You can't possess him. He's going to possess you, and you're going to lose yourself in the mystery of who he is. Well, the painter here imagines that happened through a good storyteller. A man telling those two boys about waves and whales and seas and storms and sea monsters. Those boys will build a ship because their hearts long for the immensity of the sea. What captivates them is that sea and that ocean. God pulls the eternity out of our hearts in many ways. Beauty. Music. I wanted to use another music piece, but I ran out of time and I'm going too long anyway. But Mozart. Mozart's clarinet concerto, the Adagio in D minor. It's a haunting piece, and Francis Spudford writes about it, about how he's sitting at a cafe after a terrible fight with his wife, and they ended up divorcing, and he's sitting there, and he knows he has absolutely screwed up, and this music starts playing at this cafe, and all of a sudden he's haunted, and the music talks to him from outside the world. And this was a man who at the time didn't even believe in God. He had left the church at 18, spent his whole life as an atheist in Britain, and at 60 he goes back to the church. Because Mozart called him. Something beautiful, that this exists no matter how much you've screwed up, and you are loved. Paintings, creation, crafting, poetry, storytelling, a great story and a good book. Lord of the Rings. listened to something on it this morning in David French about January 6th and the Lord of the Rings. It's wonderful. Movies. Movies. Don't underestimate the movie theater. Scripture. When the door in the imminent frame opens and we experience being part of something immense, uncontrollable, mysterious, and even unexplainable, our questions about all of our pains, they don't go away. We live with them in the mystery that there's something bigger and God is there and we can't control it. We can be in his presence, but we're there and he loves us and he's not going anywhere. But we still have all of our sorrow and pain and all of our unanswered questions because grief, all these things we go through are learning to live with all the mysterious unanswered questions of our lives. And I had another one bombard me on my way to church this morning through a beautiful text. Because those pains often open us up to hear, see things that we probably wouldn't have otherwise heard or seen, but it doesn't give any meaning to the pain. It just allows that pain to be present in the beautiful mystery of God who loves us in Jesus Christ. It can make us so deeply aware of that pain that we are unquiet in our hearts and we need the eternal God. The past 2 weeks, and I close with this, I've spent time with a Moses Lake friend. He and his wife are going through some really difficult times. Not marriage stuff, spiritual demonic stuff. And I mean it that way. They're tight. They're really good with one another. Carrie and I have known them for 25 years. Solid, wonderful people. And I haven't sat down with John in 15 years. I've seen him at a funeral or a wedding, but we haven't talked. I haven't talked to his wife, Helen, in years. I can't remember, we moved to Moses Lake in 1986. I can't remember any time when we first started, when they first moved to the community in 1995. I can't remember ever casually running into them in Moses Lake community when we lived there, just like you're out shopping or whatever. Maybe we did. But I can tell you, I haven't run into them in Moses Lake while living here in 9 years. I know that for sure. Well, I have been praying for them. Carrie and I have talked about the whole situation. And I had a scheduled meeting with John on Thursday this week. Things have been, the intensity of what's going on has just been getting greater and greater. And on Tuesday this week, Miles and I met for lunch in Moses Lake at Crisp Restaurant. Miles loves to eat there. It's not bad. You should try it. We got up to leave. We'd been there an hour and a half talking. And all of a sudden, there was Helen. And she was sitting there talking with another person. All the things that they were talking about was what was going on. And Miles had to get back, so he left, and I stood there and talked with them for 30 to 45 minutes. Now, I haven't run into anyone, Helen or John, in Moses Lake like that. In all these years, and it happened right now. Let me ask you some questions. Closed spin? Interpret that as everyone has to eat somewhere in Moses Lake. I shared that story with my friend Grant this week. And he says, oh, come on, Mark, there's only so many restaurants to eat in Moses Lake. Closed spin. I said, oh, you're just a closed spin dude. That's all. You're just interpreting that way. I'm going to interpret it another way. It's going to take faith either way because maybe it's an open take. Did a door in the imminent frame open up and the Christ was calling me to participate in something much bigger? What about you? Has God arrested your attention and making your heart thrilled and then giving you pause? You don't control it. And he's giving you a taste of eternity in your heart, and he's saying, let me just be present to you because I'm calling you into something bigger. Where are you at? Because this is the word of the Lord. He has put eternity in our hearts. everybody's heart. That's why Charles Taylor is right, because you can take an open spin or an open take or a closed spin, no matter which way you go, but you're always going to have doubt. Even you believers will have doubt in taking that open take, because you have to step out in faith. Either way. So what's it going to be? In the name of the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.